Acura's game-changing TLX, cheap gas could wreck cafe, and suddenly, Elon likes dealers.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 262 for October 17. Acura's game-changing TLX. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary Vasilash, I remember you. I recognize you. It seems like it's been forever.
We've been missing one another here, John, but things have been good.
Yeah.
Very good. And you've been traveling a lot.
I've been traveling a lot. Maybe we can get into some of that later on in the show. And I'd love to hear what you've been doing, too. But we got to let everyone know we got Michelle Krebs back with us, too.
From Auto Trader.
Yeah. Good to have you back, Michelle.
Thanks. Glad to always be here.
And, of course, we got you here to help us interview the other guy I got to introduce, Matt Hargett, the chief engineer with TLX, Acura TLX, and it's great to have you here, Matt.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
And we've got the car in the studio with us, too, which I always think helps a lot when we do these interviews, to be able to look at the product at the same time we ask you about it.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. I like that. Thank you.
So thanks for bringing it. So I've been telling everybody, to me, this is a game-changing car. I think this is a turning point for the brand. And so give us just a little thumbnail. When you set out to do this car, what did you want when you got done with it?
It was difficult at first because we knew, this was almost 6 years ago when we launched the TL, I knew that the TLX was going to replace the TSX and TL. So it's not just replacing two cars, but two potential buyers as well. So it has to encompass kind of the best of both of those cars in one. And that made it very difficult. But we also wanted to create something that had great dynamic design, a significant increase in premium feel over those outgoing two cars, and also performance at the will of the driver, what we say at Acura. So those are the three key things that we wanted, and we wrapped it all up into one concept we called Red Carpet Athlete. So the TLX, in my mind, in my heart, it's a Red Carpet Athlete.
Matt, when we were talking off camera earlier about development of platforms, development of vehicles, mm-hmm. So when we say this is an all-new vehicle, how all-new is this vehicle?
How all-new is this vehicle? It is based on our global midsize platform. There's some commonality with that, for example, the engine room body structure. But even the front floor is a higher strength steel. The rear is different because it's shorter, because we wanted a more compact package. So as an example, versus the outgoing TL, it's over 1 inch. We reduced 1 inch in the front overhang and 2.7 inches in the rear overhang. So that gives it a more compact look, like a TSX, but we kept the same wheelbase as the TL to keep that same tandem distance for spacing front to rear. So we have the same interior spacing as the TL, but the exterior dimensions are closer to TSX. So we really made a lot of modifications there. Then we have all new powertrains, chassis technology with precision all-wheel steer and super handling all-wheel drive, and a lot of unique body construction that's unique to Acura. Like in the MDX, we have a one-piece hot stamp door ring on this TLX for safety. So all around, it's a very, there's a lot of new technology on this car. Yes, we do have some shared components, like all manufacturers do these days, but it's a very exclusive vehicle.
pretty much a shared component to be invisible to someone who's getting this car.
Right, right. Like front subframe on the two-wheel drive car and the fuel tank on the two-wheel drive car. But even on even on the all-wheel drive car, those are unique and exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Matt, how important is the super handling all-wheel drive to this car and to Acura? I'm reading more and more that you're going more and more in that direction.
Well, what super handling to us is a differentiator than we could own, right? Obviously, in this segment, a lot of the competitors, they compete with FR platform, right, or all-wheel drive. But with super handling all-wheel drive, you know, we pioneered torque vectoring 10 years ago.
And explain that, just in case anybody listening doesn't understand what torque vectoring is.
Torque vectoring, so all-wheel drive system with a front engine. You've got the prop shaft sending power back to the rear differential. But in that first generation 2005 Acura RL super handling all-wheel drive, we can actually send torque, more torque, to the outside wheel to help rotate the car in a corner. So we can split the torque left to right in the rear with our rear differential. That's super handling all-wheel drive. And that's something that we pioneered in the auto industry 10 years ago. And on the new TLX, this is an all-new super handling all-wheel drive system. It's completely redesigned hardware and control logic. So
what does it do better?
So what does it do better? It does everything better. It's smaller. In fact, it was so small, at one of the media events, we had a cutaway model on a pedestal. And I had to bring up the fact that, because I didn't have it in the technical presentation, that, oh, it's back over here in the corner. And one of the journalists said, oh, that digital camera. It's not a digital camera, it's a rear differential. I had explained it could still send the same amount of torque as our outgoing SH all-wheel drive rear differential side to side, 1,200 newton meters. So it's much more compact.
And lighter weight.
Lighter weight. Yeah, we got rid of the electromagnetic clutches and the planetary gears.
So it reacts more quickly.
Yeah, so we have hydraulic clutches now. So it's much lighter, more compact. It's self-lubricating, so we got rid of the lubricating pump and motor. And we have a single motor that drives a dual pump that controls that hydraulic pressure left to right, that controls the torque distribution left to right in the rear. So it's a very clever design, only one motor. The other thing unique about it, it's the, not only does it send torque to the rear outside wheel in a turn to create a yaw moment or to help rotate the car through turns, but in high-speed driving, we can actually send torque to the rear inside wheel for the first time. And what that does is it prevents the car from rotating, so it feels more stable and secure when you're on the highway. You just feel more planted, so it's more fun to drive. So we can send torque to either the outside or inside rear wheel for the first time. The other thing we did from a control logic standpoint is the way the outgoing system worked, it would wait for a buildup of lateral Gs before it would start the torque vectoring. But now we can do it as soon as you move the steering wheel. So it looks at the rate of change of a steering wheel, and then it starts torque vectoring. So you can actually feel it going around an intersection in the city.
I could attest. It was incredibly stable on the curvy roads in here in Michigan.
But does it help with wheel slip? You know, other all-wheel drive systems are basically not about super handling.
Right.
They're about super traction.
No, that's true. It helps in any condition, right? So if you think of a snowy hill, so say you live on a hill and you're going up your driveway and one of your tires is, you know, on someone else's track and the other one's in fresh snow. You know, there's never a consistent mew condition when you're on snow and ice. So that's the beauty of super handling all-wheel drive is it's even the best all-wheel drive system in cold conditions. Thanks, Gary. I forgot about that. We keep talking about the performance, but it's good in all conditions.
Not only does this help you rotate, you've got all-wheel steer available, too, to help the car rotate even more.
Right. On the two-wheel drive versions, we have our next generation.
Not the super handling.
Right, not the super handling, right. So what we did with the super handling, as I explained before, you get that low to mid-speed agility by sending torque to the rear outside wheel, helps the car rotate, and high-speed stability by sending the torque to the inside wheel, calms the car down. That's what we did, the same thing on the two-wheel drive with the next generation precision all-wheel steer system. So we get the low to mid-speed agility by moving the rear wheels out of phase with the fronts at low to mid-speed. But at high speed, when you're on the highway, if you're going to the right, the rear wheels are also going to the right. So
they turn in phase with the front.
So then the car is not rotating, right? Similar to the all-wheel drive when it sends torque to the inside wheel. So the car literally translates from lane to lane, feels more planted, more stable and secure, so then it's more fun to drive. You just feel like you can drive the car very fast at any speed in any condition.
And don't only feel like you can drive it fast, you can drive it fast. And then there's another thing, too, that I found at driving it at speed is you'll tug the inside brake a little bit, like the rear brake. Didn't I feel that in certain situations?
Oh, maybe. You shouldn't feel it, but that's true. So what we're using the VSA system, or Vehicle Stability Assist System, the brakes, you know what that does, right? When you lose traction limit at the tire, it intervenes to calm the car down, to basically straighten it out, prevent it from rotating. But with our Agile Handling Assist System, we're using the brakes independently to actually create a yaw moment or to help rotate the car. So what it does is it extends the benefits of precision all-wheel steer up until you lose traction of the tire. And then VSA intervenes. And then it blends it all in seamlessly.
Well, maybe I didn't feel it tugging at the brake, but I did feel that rotation moment when it did happen.
Yes.
And it's just amazing. Everything that we're talking about, though, you can only really appreciate when you really start to hustle this car along. And anybody who buys it, who gets track time or, you know, a nice open road with nobody around, really has got to push this car, because that's when you appreciate how good it is.
Yeah, thanks. It's pretty fun to drive. That's one of our key goals.
So, Matt, you said they're all new powertrains, and you guys have what is said to be the world's first automotive dual-clutch transmission with torque converter?
Yes.
So explain that to us.
What it is?
Yeah.
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, this car has to replace the outgoing TSX. One of the things we found that people love about the TSX, other than the fact it's, you know, more compact and dynamic looking, is it feels peppy and zippy, right? So we wanted to enhance that even more and give it a more sporty character than even the V6 for the four-cylinder. And one way we did that was put this DCT on the car. So a DCT inherently is more sporty, right? It feels sporty, it shifts quicker, it's fun to drive. But at lower speeds, a lot of DCTs have that herky-jerky type motion around town. But obviously people in this segment don't want that in their vehicle, right? So we had to overcome that. So our solution was to use the torque converter. So what we do is we slip the torque converter at low speeds to kind of give you that smooth launching feeling of an automatic transmission. But we also can multiply the torque, so at launch, we reach peak G almost a second faster than a conventional DCT. And we can, even though the power-to-weight ratio is essentially the same as the outgoing TSX, it's 1.5 seconds faster than the TSX. And that's a lot of that's due to the torque converter. So it gives us that smooth operation at low speed, and it also multiplies the torque.
Did you guys develop this?
The
transmission?
Yeah, that's in Honda design in-house, yes.
Which blows my mind. You know, here's a company that does conventional transmissions, does its own CVT, and now is doing this hybrid DCT with a torque converter and not going outside to buy it. That's amazing.
And you've got a 9-speed as well, right?
Yes, 9-speed. And we did go outside to buy that one. That's a ZF. That's a ZF 9-speed. Automatic transmission.
I guess you can't do it all.
No, you can't do it all at one time. So, you know, they're a world-class transmission supplier. We're, you know, happy to work with them. And we put that in the V6 because that buyer wants more power, but they want it delivered in a more, in a refined manner. So it's a perfect combination for the V6. Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the other... We talked about the mechanical kind of technology. What about some of the technologies inside in the interior?
In the interior?
The dual screens and, you know.
Oh, the dual screen, yeah. That, the we call it the ODMD, on-demand display. So the upper screen's the Navi screen, and the screen below it, think of it as a reconfigurable touchscreen. Mm-hmm. So whether you're entering an address in a Navi or, you know, you're changing radio stations, we have that as well in there.
Well, it's a lovely car. I had a lot of fun.
So you've mentioned you got two new powertrains. Tell us about them. You got an i4 and a V6.
Okay, yeah, the 2.4 direct injection, we have that in some of our other models across the globe. But this one, we increased the compression ratio to 11.6 to get some more torque out of it, as well as added a dual-stage intake. So at lower RPMs, we use a long runner, and then at 3,900, it switches over to a short runner to maintain a flat torque curve, torque band across the entire range. So that, coupled with the 8 DCT that we talked about, it really enables the car to be very quick, and a lot quicker than the specs, you know, might indicate. So we're pretty happy with how that turned out. And then the V6, that's Acura's exclusive 3.5-liter direct-injected engine. It's iVTEC. It has VCM, variable cylinder management. So it switches between 3- and 6-cylinder mode, you know, when you don't need all six cylinders to help save on fuel economy. And that, coupled with the 9-speed automatic, enabled us to improve the performance on the V6 by about half a second and fuel economy by 5 miles per gallon on the highway.
So, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So what are the fuel economy figures there?
For the 2.4, it's 24 city, 35 highway. The V6 two-wheel drive is 21-34, and then the all-wheel drive is 21-31. And the reason the all-wheel drive has the same fuel economy in the city as the two-wheel drive is we added idle stop or start-stop to this car. It's the first time our company's actually implemented this technology in North America. So we decided to put it on the SH all-wheel drive car for a number of reasons. But now people that, you know, feel like they need all-wheel drive because they live in the north or in the snow belt and they really have to have it, they don't have to sacrifice as much fuel economy.
But the hybrids have always had stop-start.
Yes.
So this would be the first.
Yeah, that's true. This is the first conventional powertrain with stop-start. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And is this the first time that Honda's had or Acura's had a push-button transmission selector?
Oh, yes. Yes. With the 9-speed,
right.
It's a shift-by-wire. So we were looking at different ways to implement that shift control to replace them to traditional mechanical shifter. And we did a lot of testing on that, static and dynamic as well with different types of designs. But we went with the one that was the most easiest to use and the most intuitive for people. We didn't feel like that was something that we should play around with or get too gimmicky with, you know. Mm-hmm. It should be pretty straightforward.
But it's different than any one that I've ever seen before. Do you have any consumer reaction to it?
Yeah, we did. It was the most easy to use because, you know, push-button shifter, it's easy to see what gear you're selecting. But also the direction of motion of the switch is the direction of motion of the vehicle. So park in neutral or straight down, that means I want the car to stay right here. Reverse, I want the car to go backwards, so you pull the reverse switch back. And for drive, it's angled, so it's like you're pushing forward. You want to go and drive. So there's some thought put into it to make it more intuitive to use. And, yeah, that was extremely well received.
I like the switching, too, because there's positive detents to everything that you do. There's some other push-button transmissions out there that, the switch lights up, but you don't get that nice ka-chunk. I did.
Yeah, you have to absolutely pay attention to those lights.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So to Michelle's point earlier, does that help with interior packaging?
Oh, yes. So the other good thing about that is we have this connectivity pocket. It's located under the center stack, the dual screen that we were talking about earlier. Everybody's got a smartphone, right? As soon as they get it out, they're usually plugging it in to charge it. So what we wanted to do is provide an elegant, easy-to-access solution for people who get in and out of their car, you know, plugging their cell phone in and out. So we have this dual-layer connectivity pocket where you can hide all the wires underneath, you know, where the plugs are, either the 12-volt outlet or the USB outlet, and then just route the connector up to the top tray. It's a rubberized tray, and your phone can sit on that.
I love that. You know, it's so simple, but to hide the wire is just nice to have in your car and looking nice and tidy.
Right, yeah. We felt that in this classic car, it had to have some type of premium touch or feel.
It
even,
freaks.
I don't know if you noticed, if you drove it at night, it's actually illuminated all the time.
Oh, I've not driven this car at night.
I have not driven it at night yet either. So.
So what did you benchmark when you were developing this vehicle?
We benchmarked the competitors in this segment, the traditional, the 3 Series, the C-Class,
A4.
The A4, the outgoing, what was it, the G37, the Infiniti, and the Lexus IS is what we benchmarked for this car.
Yeah. Well, good. We'll get into more details and questions from the audience in just a minute, but we're going to take our first break and give a shout out to our friends from that car company that's never built a car.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
We're back here with Matt Hargett, the chief engineer on the Acura TLX, and we've got some questions that have come in from the audience. Tim Beaumont wants to know, why doesn't Acura offer a heated steering wheel and heated rear seats in the TLX, especially with the all-wheel drive cars? Pretty nice luxury features, as anyone who's lived up north can attest.
Yes, we looked at that. That's something that we'll look at going forward. We know that some of our competitors do have that, not all of them. But it's not something that everyone, not everyone gets it, lives up north, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So that's something that we're looking at improving in the future in terms of adding additional options in the car. But we wanted the main focus for this car was it was a driver's sports sedan first, so we called it a red carpet athlete. It's an athlete first, so we put most of our focus into that, into the body and the chassis and the new powertrains, you know, and wanted to offer it at a competitive, compelling price in a unique, you know, like in a white space in the market. So, we, you know, and sometimes you have to make those types of trade-offs when you're developing a vehicle, and our focus was more toward a performance sedan.
Well, look, I think your trade-offs were really good. I've always felt that Acura heretofore was what I call having the boy racer image and, you know, not really quite premium luxury. And here you've got a car with even better performance, but from an NVH standpoint, just the feel of the car, it feels far more premium.
Yeah, we really focused on that. Some of our two things we did, main things, suspension fitting point stiffness in some places is up 100% over the outgoing TL, and that's to get rid of that low-frequency drumming. We wanted that to be the best in the class because when you drive a car on the highway, that's what helps make a car feel premium when it's, you know, very, very quiet.
So you stiffened up the attachment points for the suspension.
Yes, so that essentially what happens is when you hit a bump, typically, into the suspension, it drives into the body, and the body panels move ever so slightly, like a speaker. So it's actually moving air, causing that low-frequency drumming. So we made them extremely, extremely rigid so that they don't move, so that you don't get that low-frequency drumming. But the other thing we did was, for the first time, we applied acoustic spray and foam in this car in 10 places around the cabin. To essentially seal off the section or prevent any air from coming into the upper cabin. Because if you prevent air from getting into the cabin, you prevent noise and sound from getting in too, right? So it's very, very quiet. I think that's one thing that we were really focusing on was we wanted our customers to notice the difference in this vehicle in the first 50 feet. And that was one of the key things that we focused on.
So
it is
it's about
very
the ride.
Quiet.
Yes.
Very quiet.
And the ride. Yes. So with that, the stiffer fitting point stiffness, we can soften up that bushing a little bit more as well. So we can keep that flat, sporty ride, but absorb some of those bumps. Mm-hmm. And our Acura Amplitude Reactive Dampers, mouthful there, the little imperfections in the road, it filters them out. So you don't feel that coming into the cabin. But a larger amplitude, like if you're going in a hard corner, the damper will actually stiffen up and keep a flat, sporty ride.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we were able to significantly improve ride and MVH in this car.
Mm-hmm. So sort of to the point of the heated steering wheel and the heated rear seats, we got a rather lengthy question from Joe in San Antonio, which I think is worth reading in its entirety.
Okay.
He says, Matt, I love the TLX. I have owned Acura sedans for 24 years, and I have test-driven the TLX, and without a doubt, the TLX is the best one yet. However, one issue troubles me, your model packaging. Acura has chosen to deny four-cylinder engine buyers Acura's very potent collision mitigation, adaptive cruise control, and road departure mitigation systems by not offering an advanced option choice for four-cylinder engine buyers. The advanced option, as you know, is only offered on the V6 engine, and that includes three safety upgrades as well as seven other nice to have goodies. As an extremely safety conscious and potential four-cylinder engine buyer, it seems to me you could capture my business by offering me and others these added safety systems without the other goodies. So, your reaction?
Yeah, that's the same. The first one thing to remember is the TSX and the TL, this car is replacing one car. So it had to cover a wide range of MSRP, right? And what we could come out with at launch, you know, is a certain amount of MTOs. All manufacturers are somewhat limited by that, right? I mean, sometimes all-wheel drive version doesn't come out till later, and things like that. So when we were looking at the lineup that in replacing the TSX and the TL, we looked at what the TSX buyers were purchasing and what the TL buyers were purchasing. You know, we made that conscious decision on the 2.4 at launch to have the standard TLX and the tech package, and then the V6 start from standard tech and advance and go up from there. But again, looking forward, you know, into the future, that's something that we're always watching, mm-hmm. the demand. And we think based on how the car's been, it's been so well received, you know, essentially demands, you know, outstripping all the supply that we have. We can't build enough of them right now. Once we see how that works out, we'll have to look into, you know, potential other packages.
Do you build them in Ohio?
Pardon?
Do you build them in Ohio?
Yeah, these are built in Ohio. Yep.
Hey, we've got another question from a viewer. Jeff Taylor from St. Louis, Missouri says, I'm a very happy owner of a 2012 Acura TL super handling all-wheel drive, and I'm very excited about the new TLX. Most of the reviews have been very favorable, but one reviewer indicated that the TLX competes more with the Taurus and Maxima than it does with the C-Class A4 or 3 Series. And he wants to know what Matt thinks of that statement.
Yeah.
I don't see this against
I'd like to know. I'd like to know what Michelle thinks of that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, and I owned a TL long ago.
You might
Taurus.
Be better to answer because honestly, you know, working for
mind.
Acura and benchmarking this car against competition, I haven't driven a Maxima or a Taurus, so I can't say, but I can't believe.
Well, the Maxima, that's
they're
going to be
way bigger cars to begin
yeah,
with.
Yeah,
right.
I wouldn't put them in that category.
No.
Right. I mean, just everything that we focused on, that significant increase in premium feel that you're going to feel in 50 feet, best in class road noise, wind noise, ride, and the performance that we have with these new powertrains and super handling technologies. I don't even understand how that can be compared to those other two cars.
Yeah.
You know, Matt, something we keep touching on it, price. I mean, the price range is, what, 30 to 45-ish?
Right. 39.95 on the 2.4 standard. It's
matches out 45-ish. Is that about right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other thing we're pretty proud of. You know, that's when you're developing a vehicle, it's easy to add a lot of cost and weight to the car, right? That's real simple. But it's hard to actually create something that, you know, is really fun to drive or top class and a lot of you know, attributes in your category and then offer it at this price.
We got another question here. George from Plymouth says, okay, I'm sold on the TLX, but what should I get? The super handling all-wheel drive or stick with the paws?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I think all the...
And explain paws, too.
Oh, paws. Precision all-wheel steer.
Okay.
That's a two-wheel drive.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Would it depend on where you live and how much you need all-wheel drive?
Yeah, and what your financial constraints are, yes. Of course. But if you want something a little bit more sporty and fun to drive, that's the 2.4 with precision all-wheel steer and the 8-speed DCT. You know, if you want someone who likes more power and you don't need the all-wheel drive, that's the V6 two-wheel drive. And the all-wheel drive is for people who want, you know, something with the push from the rear. You know, or they want the all-wheel drive traction. They live in the snow belt, so it's hard to say. I guess it depends on your mood. I flip between the 2.4 and the SH all-wheel drive. It's a toss-up.
George, sounds like you're going to have to buy two cars.
Yeah, buy them both. Okay, JM1NB wants to know premium fuel.
Recommended, not required. Recommended. Yep.
And Homer wants to know what car are you currently working on.
Oh, well, we can't say, but I'm not working on a car at the moment. I'm now vice president of Acura Research and Development. So
that's right. I forgot. So even though I introduced you as chief engineer, I kind of demoted you there until this segment of the show, and now you're promoted.
So were you the large project leader for this car?
Yes. I was the large project leader for this car.
So you were the chief engineer.
Yeah, but not for the next car. I'll overseeing the R&D.
So we should be asking you about the NSX.
But I can't tell you too much. Although I will tell you, it's extremely fun to drive, and we're looking forward to launching that next year.
So what other cars have you worked on in your career?
Actually, going all the way back to around 97 or 98, I worked on the Acura CL Coupe, and then the 01 CL, the 2004 TL, the 2009 TL, and 10 with the manual SH all-wheel drive, and now the 2015 TLX. Okay.
Well, Matt Hargett, thanks so much for coming on the show and especially bringing the TLX along with you. Very interesting. Terrific car. Might be one of the contenders for North American Car of the Year. We'll see how the voting goes. But as I said at the beginning of the show, to me, this is a turning point for the brand.
Yeah, it is, and we're looking forward to our future, and it's pretty exciting, actually. Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a quick break and show you some things that you may have missed if you haven't been watching Autoline. We'll catch you up right here.
Have you seen what's been happening with our other shows? Here's this week's Auto Lineup. Starting with John's one-on-one with Mr. Electric Car himself, Elon Musk, dropping quite a few interesting Tesla tidbits throughout. Then we also heard from Toyota reps on the mid-cycle refresh of the 2015 Camry, which was really more like the unveiling of an entire brand new car. And then finally, John talks powertrains from his day driving the candidates for the North American Truck of the Year. For more details on these stories and others, check our website or click on our YouTube channel. And don't forget our latest episode of Autoline This Week with a special interview with the chair of the National Auto Dealers Association. All that and more on Autoline.tv.
So really interesting, you know, that he was, what was the term that you used, the large?
Large project leader.
Which is sort of Honda speak for chief engineer.
Right. Right.
And I'm just fascinated that more and more of that development work is being done in the United States.
Although, you know, it's sort of interesting to think, though. I mean, he mentioned that he went back to the CL, and the CL was actually developed here. And remember Charlie Baker?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was Charlie was the LPL on that car. Mm-hmm. And you know, unlike some of the other brands, it's at Honda. For a large part of their history in the United States, they've actually been having their engineers and designers working on products for this market. Mm-hmm. And this is probably a culmination of a lot of the work they've done right here.
It is, because, you know, when Honda first got going here building cars, you know, it was accused of just being, you know, like a screwdriver shop, that all the parts would come in from Japan and they'd screw it all together. And, you know, then they did a few things here or there. But to me, it's just extraordinary how much capability that they've got in the U.S. right
now. Well, in R&D, I mean, they've got lots of R&D going on in the Columbus area, and they've got, we were talking about things they're doing here and there, all kinds of high-tech things they're doing here in the United States.
Yeah, you go down to Central Ohio, you know, the Columbus area, I mean, they've got the largest engine plant that Honda has anywhere in the world is in Anna, Ohio. Mm-hmm. They've got their R&D center in Raymond, Ohio. They've got their plant in East Liberty, Ohio. They've got the original Marysville plant in Marysville, Ohio, where they do a lot of the engineering work. I mean, they're really plugged into to that part of the world and have really concentrated their efforts. So it's sort of interesting, you know, if you think about Toyota moving
to Plano, Texas,
but keeping stuff in Ann Arbor, you know, that certainly Honda / Acura has its headquarters facilities in Torrance, but the amount of facilities and resources and capabilities that they have in the Midwest is just really astonishing.
Yeah. The only one criticism I have of this car, and I didn't get into it with Matt because he doesn't address that, is the styling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's better, but it isn't there yet.
They haven't quite figured it out. You know, what is that? What's an Acura supposed to look like?
I know they're working on an all-new form language. I don't know if we'll see it at the Detroit show or New York or Geneva or I don't know where. I know they're working on it, and it might be just around the corner, but we will see the new styling that they want to take the whole brand in.
So do you think that you're more aware of that because of the radical shift that Lexus has made in its design language for all of its vehicles now?
No, I think
it was because that goofy grill that they had on the Acuras was just so bad. I mean, I think it's held them back. It's hurt them. And you know, I've talked with the design people, you know, Dave Merrick, who runs Acura Design, and he won't tell me anything about it, but I do know something new is coming.
Well, that all speaks, and I think brand is really important. I know people, it's not quite there yet in terms of competing. It may have all the bits and pieces to compete with the Audis and BMWs, but design goes a long way towards determining what the brand is, I think. So they're just not quite there yet on that. Not quite figured out what is an Acura.
Yeah. Well, I think making Acura more of a standalone operation, you know, with Eric Berkman, you know, doing all the business stuff for it, you know, Dave Merrick now running design for all Acura, and there's others too, but I'll mention those two names. I think we're going to see big changes coming out of that. I see it being much more focused, you know, just like Lincoln,
Cadillac getting,
you know, now Acura getting more. It's going to get intense in that part of the segment if these three brands that I just mentioned really get their act together.
Right.
You know, and you were talking earlier, Michelle, about this notion that they might go all-wheel drive right across the board, and that would be a differentiator for them. Do you think that's sufficiently different?
I don't know that that's a... I think a design has a lot to do with it, too. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to know going down the street what that is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's.
Should pick it out 100 yards away.
Yeah. But I look at that and I say, okay, that looks like an Acura. Now, I don't know that it addresses what you're talking about having something that is like, whoa, that's an Acura. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know what it is, you know, so.
But you're also more familiar with different vehicles too.
Sure.
And I'm talking about like the buyers out there,
the
luxury buyers, the luxury wanna buy.
Yeah. Well, we all knew what an Aztec was, but for all the
wrong
you know, there's one thing to stand out.
A little harsh, John. We don't got an Aztec here.
No.
Hey, jumping topics. I got something I'm dying to ask you guys. Today I stopped at a gas station, $2.98.
Ooh, I didn't get that good a deal. I got $3.11.
$2.98, and I think it's going to go down even more. And what do you guys think about this? And I'm not asking necessarily from a consumer standpoint. What's this do to an industry that's got these ever ratcheting up CAFE standards to meet?
Well, and you can chart, you know, hybrid sales and those those kind of sales against gas prices, and they're opposite direction. When the gas prices go way down, the sales of those typically go down, and they have been soft.
So they've dropped 8% this year, over 8%, in a market that's up, what, 5% or something like that.
Of course,
that.
A lot of that has to do with the fact that the gasoline engine is still getting better and better fuel economy, so why bother with a...
Of course, I learned something very interesting this week, John.
What's that?
Camry sales, okay? 10% of Camry sales are hybrids. 6% of Camry sales are V6s. So there you go. Here's a case where... And I thought that I mean, the Camry hybrid is the most invisible hybrid on the face of the earth. I mean, most people probably didn't know they have one. But the hybrid is outselling the six-cylinder engine in that car.
Well, what's the price difference, do you know, between them? Because usually in Camry and Accord, you pay for a V6, you pay big bucks to get it. And
some of the Prius models are priced pretty very well down at the lower end.
I almost wonder if Hyundai now regrets it didn't put a V6 in the Sonata, just because of the money that you can charge to get them. But I think this is a benefit and a threat to the auto industry, cheap gas prices, that is. Because, how do you meet CAFE when the consumer is no longer motivated to pay a big premium, in most cases, to get a plug-in or an electric or even a hybrid? What does the industry do?
But I still go back to, they've got more to choose from at this point in terms of fuel economy. I mean, he was talking about this car can get over 30 miles a gallon. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that was not possible, with bigger engines. I think it's amazing what engineers have done with internal combustion gasoline engines.
But I think to your point, John, this whole issue of, okay, what if you're a product planner at a car company? Okay, what are you thinking about now? I mean, are you thinking about having vehicles that are, you know, exceedingly lightweight? Are you thinking about more downsized engines, turbocharged engines, and on and on and on? Are you thinking about electrified powertrains? Or are you thinking, gee whiz, maybe we don't have to do any of that stuff. Maybe we can go, you know, back the way it was. I mean, how's that aluminum F-150 looking now, right?
Well, you know, again, Ford only did that because of CAFE.
Right.
It wasn't the customer saying, hey, you know, you ought to take 700 pounds out of this truck. They were happy with the truck as it was. And that's where... Well, I guess I should say, as you guys know, in 2017, there's supposed to be what they call a midterm review to say, do these CAFE standards still make sense? Politically, I don't see how anybody can back off that.
Well, we'll see what the president of Venezuela, who is a OPEC member, does. He wants them to turn the spigot off and
drive up prices.
Because Venezuela's a
basket. And that's the other thing. Something could happen.
Right.
Yeah. Well, look, let's get into more of this, but we got to take another break and give a shout out to our good friends at Hyundai, and we'll get there in just a sec.
Nice. Not. Nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
So what else have you guys been up to that's worth talking about?
Well, you and I have been out in Hell, Michigan, driving all the candidates for North American Car and Truck of the Year, and that's always interesting. So,
well, number one, we all love telling everyone we know we're going to hell.
Exactly, because there's so many jokes that can be made. Yes,
but yeah, it's
a real interesting year. I mean, there's a couple standouts, but there's, I mean, if you look at the truck and utility category, which we combine, there's a lot of good stuff in that category. Probably the strongest we've seen in a long, long time, I think.
Well, what I like about Hell Week is that you get to drive a bunch of vehicles back to back to back to back, and there's
no way
to learn about a car so quickly. I do a 12.2-mile loop. It takes me about 20 minutes to do it, so I can get in roughly about three cars an hour. But, wow,
You learn a lot.
You learn so much. 20 minutes, you learn.
Even hopping in and out and looking at how things are set up, and there's so much you can learn just by having them all in one place.
So tell us what you learned about fuel economy of pickup trucks, John. I thought that was very interesting.
So, yeah, I got the Chevy Colorado, the GMC Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I did the four-cylinder Chevy, the V6 GMC.
The Silverado.
I got 2.7 liter. No, the Silverado wasn't there,
okay.
Or I didn't drive it. I drove the 2.7 liter Ford F-150 EcoBoost and the 3.5 liter Ford F-150 EcoBoost.
Right.
And what I want to say is that the Ford F-150 2.7 liter got the same fuel economy as the GMC Canyon with a V6. So even though the Ford is a much bigger and more capable truck, it got the same fuel economy for the route that I drove. The four-cylinder, that was about 18.9 miles per gallon, if I remember right. With the four-cylinder, I got 22 miles per gallon. But then I decided, even though it's not up for Truck of the Year, I got in the Ram 1500 pickup truck with the diesel engine, the 3-liter diesel, and just whomped them all. It got better fuel economy than the four-cylinder Chevy Colorado. It got 30% better than fuel economy than the Ford 2.7 liter. Now, the Ford guys are telling me, oh, but it doesn't have the capability that ours does. Nonetheless, I'm very interested that when you look at these
strategies,
you're doing a
lot of price comparisons,
too. If you're a car company and you've got these pickups and you go, what do I got to do here? Should I go like Ford did? Very intensive in aluminum and go lightweighting, or should I do as GM did and downsize and save weight, or as Ram did, go with a diesel and beat everybody?
Of course, you know, it's very interesting, this whole notion of the smaller Colorado. So I don't know if anybody's,
I don't know if anybody's
noticed this, but that actually, so if we look at the smallest F-150 you can get, the regular cab F-150, and the smallest Colorado you can get, the length of the smallest F-150 is 209.3 inches. The smallest Colorado you can get is 212.7 inches.
It's bigger. The smallest small truck is bigger than the smallest big truck.
Yeah, we can't call it a small truck.
Right.
It really is.
And actually, the Colorado is longer than the Ram as well, 209 inches for the Ram.
Wow.
So, I was...
And about same size as a full-size pickup truck, 10 years ago, maybe?
You know, that's a great point that you make, Gary, because one of the selling points of the smaller GM trucks is they're garageable.
Garageable, yep.
But are they, if they're that long?
Oh, I'm sure they are. But it's interesting because I was looking at the number, because I was writing a story about the F-150, and I was looking at the numbers, and actually it is, in the regular cab, smaller than the previous generation truck. They're like, oh, you know, don't pay attention to that. It's a very small percentage sold regular cab. Just ignore that.
What I found driving them in Hell Week, because when we were on the media launch where we did After Hours a few weeks ago, we were driving back-to-back with the Toyota Tacoma and Nissan Frontier, and the GM trucks are miles ahead of them.
Oh, because
miles.
Those haven't been redone in years
anyway.
Yeah,
the Japanese trucks are got to be updated. But when I got in this F-150 versus the Colorado or the Canyon, wow, it's so much smoother, better behaved. The GM trucks are trucks. I mean, they feel like trucks. But what it also hit me is I think these GM trucks are going to attract a younger buyer. You know, 20 and 30 somethings or 40 somethings who still want to be 30 somethings, and I'm becoming more and more believing that GM's going to pull this off. I think they're going to attract a new younger buyer into the segment.
Maybe they're also competing against a lot of sport utilities, though. They're expecting a lot of people to come out of sport utilities.
You don't think that's going to happen?
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that's going to happen.
All right, so as Wright Knight points out, there is no regular cab for the Colorado Canyon. It is actually the extended cab, but it's still the shortest. It's still bigger than the F-150, so
that's right.
We're both right there. So you talked to Elon Musk.
I talked to Elon Musk. I did an interview with him at this industry conference and got some good things out of him. Now, you got to remember, too, in this era of Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, nobody can go to a conference and say off-the-record stuff. So anything that Elon said had been said previously. But I hadn't heard a lot of it, and I think if I haven't heard it, a lot of people haven't either.
Now, was this before the big announcement that wasn't such
no,
a big
No, this
announcement?
Was after the big okay. announcement, okay. which everybody yawned at.
Yes.
You made a big deal out of having all-wheel drive.
Woo-hoo.
It's not even super handling all-wheel drive.
Yeah, yeah.
And you made a big deal about having adaptive cruise. Big yawn.
Yeah, catching up.
So, I mean, the stock took a hit. But the things that I got out of Elon that I found very interesting is I asked him, is your company store model really scalable? I mean, really? Are you going to get into all 50 states with your company stores? And what about service and repairs? None of these stores are set up to do this. You know, your car breaks down, you put it on a flatbed, and you got to ship it all over, you know, the country. And he admitted, no, he says we're probably going to have to end up with some sort of hybrid system of mm-hmm. both company stores and use the franchise dealer system specifically for repairs. He mentioned if it's body repair, stuff like that, other shops can do it. But if you get into Tesla-specific technology, no one out there can fix it.
Well, and the other thing that they announced recently that we found really interesting was that they're going to start a certified pre-owned program because now there are starting to be some used Teslas out there.
Yeah, because they're running to the BMW i8.
Yeah. But, you know, they have to have a way to deal with those, too. So, you know, do you do it through the company stores? Do you do it through some kind of hybrid deal?
Remember when some Kmarts took their auto service centers and turned them over to Penske?
Yes.
And they were Penske auto centers.
Right.
So conceivably, couldn't Elon have a situation whereby they'd have company stores and then he would give it to Penske?
Isn't that what Daewoo tried to do?
Well, wait
also?
A minute. Remember last week, Warren Buffett just
yes.
bought the Van Tuyl Auto Group. So might you not talk with him? Or those others are speculating because Warren Buffett owns stock in BYD, the Chinese company, that this is going to be the entree for the Chinese.
Build your dreams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, build your dreams. That's right. So, yeah, no, this is going to be very interesting, you know, how Tesla, you know, has this hybrid system.
I wonder how Tesla feels about cheap gas. Does it make any difference?
Not to their buyers.
I wouldn't.
Because their buyers want to show that they've got electric, they're saving the planet. And by the way, you get that HOV lane sticker that's so desirable.
Yes, that's right. And you have something that's kind of rare. I think what's going to be interesting is when they get more vehicles out there, you know, is this the kind of group of buyers that goes on to the next, you know, the newest, greatest thing? Will they stay with the brand? I think that's going to be interesting to see.
Well, Tesla's got to do more in it, and that's the other thing that one of the other things Elon talked about in the interview that I did, that with his Gigafactory, he thinks he can drive down costs significantly. A few years back when Stephen Chu was still Department of Energy Secretary, he set a goal of for battery makers to hit $125 in cost per kilowatt hour. Some estimates are that Tesla right now is at $240, more or less. MIT estimates most everybody's actually over $400 per kilowatt hour. But if Elon says in time when they scale up, he's going to get to $100 per kilowatt hour, and I did some quick calculations on their top line 85 kilowatt hour car, that would take $12,000 cost out of it. So $12,000 cost reduction in the batteries, pretty significant.
Well, speaking of Chinese electric cars, and so on, I just was reading today that Nanyang Technology University...
Easy for you to say.
I missed that article.
...has developed an ultra-fast charging batteries that can be charged up to 70% in 2 minutes. And they're basically saying that they're replacing the graphite used for the anode in lithium-ion batteries with a new gel material made from titanium dioxide, which was highly available. It's not some rare sort of thing. So, and they're also saying that these batteries will last 10 times longer. What happens when you're building a gigafactory that is all capacitized to make a certain type of lithium-ion batteries?
And something better comes along.
And these guys come up with this thing, and it says four guys have been working on it for 3 years. And you know, they're saying that this could, you know, conceivably, you know, and the guy talks about electric cars. He's saying that, you know, electric cars will be able to increase their range dramatically with just 5 minutes of charging. Okay, what happens then to all the supercharger stations and things like that? And
well, and they aren't the only ones. I mean, everybody's working on all kinds of different battery things. So what happens if something comes up? Somebody comes up with something better.
There's an Ann Arbor startup called SACT-E3 that's building what it calls, and I don't understand it at all, but they call it solid-state batteries. Mm-hmm. And there's a woman named Ann Marie Silvestri who runs that. We just shot Sastry. Thank you, Ben. Ann Marie Sastry. We just shot a show for AutoLine this week that hasn't aired yet. She says they're going to come out of the box at $100 per kilowatt hour.
Sure.
In just a matter of years, not the 10 years that Elon's projecting. So great question, Gary. Yeah, what do you do if you put $5 billion into a factory that all of a sudden is obsolete?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'll say this, and you guys have run into this too. Every time you turn around, somebody's got a battery breakthrough. Every time you look, some university or some research group, they've got the next solution. But they're not in any car.
You got to commercialize it and get it
in. You know, and so... You know how long it takes once you get something proven to get it into a vehicle? You're talking 4 or 5 years. And that's once you get it to a truly proven standpoint, not just saying so in a press release. But you make a really good point. This technology could be turned upside down.
I mean, just think. I mean, okay, even if we're taking 4 to 5 years to get it in production, so we're talking, what, 2020 now?
Mm-hmm.
And if you suddenly have this wherewithal that you're going to have a vehicle that is going to have, you know, maybe it'll go as fast as the Model D will go, and it'll cost a fraction of what a Model D costs. And
messes with your business model, doesn't it?
It messes with everything. And so suddenly, I mean, even if gas stays cheap, I mean... Suddenly, gas has a run for its money, right? I mean, that people are going to suddenly say, well, gee whiz, I'd rather not go to that service station. I'd just rather plug this thing in. Mm-hmm. And, oh, it's going to take 5 minutes? Well, who cares, right?
And there goes the fuel cell. It's still 20 years in the future.
It's always going to be 20 years, isn't it? It's been in our careers.
Oh, so we had Monty Kaher, the chief engineer of the Camry, on the show 2 or 3 months ago. And I finally got the chance to drive the new 2015 Camry.
Which is a significant refresh, right?
It's
mid-cycle, right?
It's the only sheet metal on that car that is the same with the car that was introduced in 2011 as a 2012 model is the roof. Because he said they saw no advantage in changing the roof because, you know, what are you going to do to the styling if you change the roof? Because they wanted to keep the cabin as it was. But all the sheet metal is different. The IP is different.
Good. I mean, I didn't like that IP.
They've just completely.
And they're going to redo it again really quickly too.
What do you think of the car?
I think what they've done and they've done a couple of things is that they came out with the SE model that was sort of the sportier Camry, and that exceeded all of their expectations in terms of sales. Okay, that it just they were astonished. So they've put a trim level above that, the XSE, which I said. Dyslexic people might have a problem with because
it's sex.
And because their top luxury trim level is XLE, so now they have the XSE. So, you know, they all look sporty, they look faster, but they kept the powertrain. Okay, so the suspension is slightly adjusted on these sport models, but it's still a Camry, and
they'll still sell a boatload of them.
Yeah, and in fact, it was very interesting because they're saying that they expect to sell more this year than they sold last year, and so they're thinking that maybe it's gonna be like 415 million units.
No, 450,000.
Yeah, I was going to say million. I was like, oh, it was out of my mouth. I thought, wow, that's a lot of cars. so they think they're going to sell even more. But it was just sort of interesting that Monty sort of indicated that a lot of this came from Akio Toyoda saying that he wanted cars that
were emotional.
More emotional and more appealing to people. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and as we all know, that Toyotas have long been described as being appliances.
Mm-hmm. Vanilla. And
plain vanilla.
Right. And so now I think they're upping the game some in terms of what they're doing. But you know, but it's sort of interesting. If you also remember, we had Mike Swears on, who was the chief engineer for the Tundra, and you remember that we were talking about the powertrain, and they didn't change the powertrain because he kept saying, well, the customers don't want that, or the customers don't want to pay for that. And I thought, gee, Monty's basically telling me the same thing for the Camry, that people are very satisfied with the 6-speed automatic transmission and the, you know, the V6 and the i4 engine, and you know, that's just fine. And so I just wonder if
it's, and maybe it is.
But it probably is.
Yeah.
You know, and I just wonder, is it like us who are driving people to change things to make it more peppy or
No, I think it's the competition. I mean, you know, the Camry, the prior generation to what you just drove, really didn't sell well. I mean, you know, Accord closed the gap, I believe. Sales-wise, I'm talking about.
It's still number one.
It's still number one.
And Toyota's going to do anything it can to keep it number one. You know, 0% financing, whatever it takes.
You know, look, Hyundai has just improved the Sonata. The Fusion's done very well for Ford. Mm-hmm. Malibu, they're still working on that. But Camry faces much more competition. And
their average transaction prices have gone down, too, whereas in the industry, you know, Ford's way up there because mm-hmm. they've had to discount it more over the years and that kind of thing. So, they'll do what they can to keep
How's that segment doing, Michelle?
Well, the midsize segment.
Are SUVs eating into crossovers?
Yes, indeed, absolutely. You know, the midsize segment is still huge. It's over 4 million vehicles a year, but it is getting squeezed because people seem to think that sport utilities are crossovers are more versatile.
And that's a global thing, too, not just here in the U.S.
Yes, and, you know, we've seen, it's almost been, in the sales sphere, it's been different worlds, because that world is the average transaction prices going down, more incentives going on, and just competition's wicked, but total opposite of the crossovers, where the transaction prices are much higher and less incentives, so...
But
I wonder how long that'll last that way. That's what I wonder. Because there's more and more, you know, of those crossovers coming in. A lot of them look awfully similar.
They do.
In terms of styling. So I think that's why the Jeep Cherokee has done so well. It kind of broke out in terms of styling.
Isn't Jeep that amazing? You know, because everybody took one look at it and thought, wow, it looks like it just bit into a lemon.
I said that was would be a winner from day one. And the purists, I got terrible hate mail. And
well,
it's done really. It's the best-selling vehicle at Chrysler.
You were right.
I won't go into product planning because of that, but
you ought to. What the hell? Of course, you got all this gas problem to worry about.
So you got anything else there?
No. I was just looking. You know, we're talking about the sales of Camry, and ain't doing so bad this year. It's 334,846 through September, and the closest comparison, since I don't have the Honda number. Is the Fusion is down at 240,585.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's
a big gap.
A big gap.
But remember, they didn't have the production capacity either until they added the one line Mazda plant.
If we were to look to see how the aforementioned Malibu is doing.
Oh, that's not
that's
even
close.
That's
down at 148,574.
Yeah.
So I guess the only happiness that they could have with the Malibu is when they look at the fact that the 200 sales are half that, so
it's
got to be some port in the storm for them, right?
Well, there's always something interesting to talk about in this business.
Always.
That's for sure. But look, probably time to wrap it up. I'm so glad we had Matt here with the TLX. And Michelle, great having you back on the show, too.
Me.
And Gary, it's great to see you again.
Yeah.
So
good
let's
be
do
here
it again next week.
Except I won't be here next week.
Oh, jeez.
So week after, John.
Okay. We'll do it again. And
all right.
Want to thank all of you for having joined us this week, and come on back next.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.